I think we're ready to start. Good morning. My name is Ginny Bouvier. I'm here at the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program, and on behalf of the Institute and the program, I'd like to welcome you here. We are celebrating today the release of the latest USIP special report by Barbara Slavin, Mullahs, Money, and Militia, How Iran Exerts Influence in the Middle East. This new report by one of our senior fellows focuses on Iran's interactions with groups in Lebanon, Iraq, and to a lesser extent, the Palestinian territories. It's an important and controversial topic, one that may hold the key to the future of war and peace in the Middle East region. We're pleased to have been able to support Barb's contribution to helping us better understand the nature, the goals, and the politics of the Iranian presence in the region, and we're looking forward to an exciting discussion this morning. Barb's work complements USIP's other work on the Middle East. To mention just two initiatives, the Conflict Analysis and Prevention Center has sponsored an ongoing program series on Iraq and its neighbors that resulted in a number of relevant publications that are available on the table outside. We're also pleased to be hosting another senior fellow, Avner Cohen, here in the front row, who's been working on nuclear issues relating to Iran. Dr. Cohen is also finishing out his fellowship year this year, his fellowship year now at the Institute. Dan Brumberg, who is on our panel and head of the Special Muslim World Initiative, can tell you more about USIP's initiatives in that realm. Joining Barb on this morning's panel are three seasoned experts on the Middle East who will be commentators, Dan Brumberg, Mona Yacoubian, and Kenneth Katzman. Their bios are available on the table outside, so I'll introduce them only briefly. First, we'll lead off with Barb Slavin. She was formerly a senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today and is just finishing her year as a Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's made six trips to Iran, seven now, and has traveled extensively and conducted interviews throughout the region and with U.S. policymakers here in Washington. Barb is the author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She's written for the New York Times, The Economist, Businessweek, Newsday, and the Los Angeles Times, and she's a frequent commentator on National Public Radio, C-SPAN, and PBS. As a senior fellow here, Barb has been an engaged colleague and consultant, author of frequent op-eds, and a highly sought-after speaker on the East Coast and all across the country. We'll, after she does her initial presentation, we'll open up for discussants. We'll start off with Kenneth Katzman, who's a senior analyst specializing in Persian Gulf affairs, particularly Iran and Iraq, for the Congressional Research Service. His writings include most notably The Warriors of Islam, Iran's Revolutionary Guard by Westview Press. Then we'll turn to Mona Yacoubian, who's a special advisor to the Institute's Muslim World Initiative. She's worked on a broad range of issues in the region, including democratization and civil society promotion, as well as counterterrorism strategy. Yacoubian has consulted for a number of organizations, including the World Bank, Department of State, Rand Corporation, and Freedom House, and is author of the monograph Algeria's Struggle for Democracy. And finally, we'll have the cleanup hitter, Dan Brumberg, who's the acting director of USIP's Muslim World Initiative for the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. He's also an associate professor at Georgetown University. His research has focused on issues of democratization and political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world, and he's currently working on a comparative study of power sharing in Algeria, Kuwait, and Indonesia. Now, before turning the podium over to Barbara, a couple of housekeeping items. I would just ask you first to please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices you have. It's not just because of the interruption that they can cause during the event, but we are taping this event today, and it will interfere with the microphone system and the sound system. The event is being recorded live. You can find the recording on the USIP website, usually within a week, at www.usip.org. And finally, for the media in the room, I would remind you that the panelists' views do not necessarily reflect the views of the Institute, which does not advocate specific policies. And now I'll turn it over to Barb.
Thanks, Jenny. And thank all of you for coming out on such a hot day. I see a lot of friendly faces in the audience, and it's really good to have you here. This is kind of a culmination of my 10 months at USIP. It's been a wonderful year. I want to thank the U.S. Institute of Peace for giving me the opportunity to do this research away from daily deadlines, and especially for allowing me to go to the Middle East for an entire month in March, which was a real luxury, and a chance to go back to Iran, to go to Lebanon, and also to go to Jordan. I also want to thank Charles Krauthammer for this research. It was actually reading an op-ed that he wrote about a year and a half ago that gave me the idea to do this research. He compared Iran under the Ayatollahs to the old Soviet Union, and he said that Iran's efforts to spread its influence in the region, in the Middle East, was like the old Soviet Comintern that tried to spread communism around the world. With all due respect to Mr. Krauthammer, I lived in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, and as was mentioned, I've been to Iran now 7 times, and Iran is no Soviet Union. If there are similarities, I think it's primarily in terms of the internal disaffection of many of the Iranian people for their own government. But I think we've all learned that historical analogies are rather dangerous things, and one should be careful in making these kinds of comparisons. Unlike the Soviet Union, Iran does not yet have nuclear weapons. Its troops occupy no neighboring states. And while its influence is certainly much greater than it was 7 years ago, I think its influence is still constrained by a number of factors, both internal and external. My aim in producing this report was to try to really do something that was balanced and non-hysterical, neither underestimating nor hyping the challenge that Iran presents. For practical reasons of time and resources, I decided to focus on Iraq and Lebanon, a little bit on Palestinian territories. Iraq, obviously, because the United States handed Iran enormous leverage there when it overthrew Saddam Hussein in 2003, and because we still have so many U.S. troops there. And Lebanon, because it's the home of Hezbollah, which is Iran's most successful external creation, and because Lebanon is frequently a kind of combat zone, an ideological combat zone, and a real combat zone between the West, Israel, and Saudi Arabia on one side, and Iran and Syria on the other. So I focused on 3 major ways in which Iran exerts influence, both hard and soft power: religious ties, financial aid, and weapons and training to Arab militias, hence the title. Starting with the mullahs, this is what clerics are popularly called in Iran and through the region. I think I'll begin by looking at what I call the Shiite triangle, and this is the historic and blood ties among the clerics of Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon. I knew something about this when I started, but I went deeper and deeper into this, and it's really quite fascinating. The clerical ties between Iran and Iraq obviously go back to the beginnings of Islam, when both were part of the same Islamic empire. The ties between Iran and Lebanon developed especially beginning in the 16th century, when the Safavid rulers of Persia decided to make Shiism the state religion. And they didn't have enough clerics, so they had to import them, and many of them came from Lebanon, particularly the Jabal Amal region of Lebanon, where Shiites were suffering persecution from the Sunni Ottoman Turkish rulers. So it was a neat fit. Many of these Lebanese also went to Najaf, which until the Iranian Revolution in 1979 was really the center for Shiite religious instruction. So to illustrate the Shiite triangle, and this was very fortuitous, I was in Qum in March, and I met a Safavid scholar who gave me this amazing chart. And it's on two slides. I don't know how well you can see it, but we'll stick with this side. This is the family tree of the Sadrs. I want to thank my research assistant, Russ Burns, who translated it and figured out how to put this into Microsoft Excel, which was no small feat. Yeah. It traces the Sadr family, starting with the 7th Shiite Imam, Musa Kazim, up here. He was an 8th century religious leader. He's buried in the section of Baghdad that's named for him, Kazimane. And the chart shows 187 of Musa Kazim's male descendants. Of course, the women don't count, as we know, in the Middle East. At least not in those days. Those in white are either brothers or the end of a particular male line. And so we've highlighted 9 of them, starting with Musa Kazim. Then we go to Ibrahim Sharafdin Ameli over here. He emigrated to Najaf from the Jabal Amal section of Lebanon in the 17th century, and his great-grandson, Sadr al-Din Isfahani, very central figure here, as you might gather from the name, emigrated to Isfahan, which was then the capital of Safavid Persia. If you turn to the 20th century, we have a very, very important crop of Sadrs, beginning with Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr down here. And if, Russ, if you want to go to the next slide, I'll keep on going. This is Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr. He's a very key figure, someone who's not talked about enough, I think. He was a contemporary of the Iranian revolutionary leader Ayatollah Khomeini. They studied together. He really began the Shiite political revival. He co-founded the first Shiite political party, Dawah, and his writings contributed to Khomeini's theory of velayat-i faqih, or rule by a supreme cleric or council of clerics. He also influenced numerous other important figures, including Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, an Iraqi-born cleric who went to Lebanon, later became the spiritual leader of Hezbollah. Bakr al-Sadr was a virulent opponent of the Ba'athists, and in 1980, the regime of Saddam Hussein executed him. Another very important Sadr, if we go to the next one, this is the Imam Musa al-Sadr. He was born in Qum, Iran. He moved to Lebanon in 1959, retracing the family's ancestral journey in reverse. And he organized the first mass movement of Shiites in Lebanon, and also their first militia, Amal, during the Lebanese Civil War in the 1970s. He disappeared in 1978 at the height of his popularity while he was on a trip to Libya. And there are many theories about what happened to him. The assumption is the Libyans killed him. The question is at whose behest. Some say Khomeini had him killed because he was jealous of him. He was very charismatic, wonderful speaker, more popular than Khomeini in some ways among Shia. Some think that the Shah of Iran had him killed because although he originally took money from the Shah for humanitarian activities in Lebanon, he later began to consort with the opposition to the Shah. Many Iranian opposition figures moved to Lebanon in the 1970s, and they were organizing against the Shah. Or it could have been the Palestinians, because the Palestinians and Lebanese Shia were beginning to clash at that time. He was a more moderate figure than Khomeini. He didn't believe in velayat-i faqih. And yet, Hezbollah still talks about him. They say that there would have been no Hezbollah without the Imam Musa al-Sadr, without the consciousness raising that he did among the Shia of Lebanon. So going back to Iraq now, if we could, I'm sure everyone is familiar with this Sadr. After Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr was executed by Saddam Hussein, his cousins took up the cause, the Sadr family cause, and three of them were also killed by the regime in 1999, and the baton was passed to the young Muqtada al-Sadr, who is now the preeminent leader of poor and working class Iraqi Shiites. He's said to be an Iraqi nationalist, but he's also said to be spending a lot of time in Iran these days. And, you know, there have been so many different stories about where he is and with whom he's studying. When I was in Qum, I asked whether anybody had seen him, whether he was studying with Ayatollah Ha'eri, who is an Iraqi cleric who is in Qum. Nobody had seen him. So is he in Qum? Is he in Najaf? We really don't know. I think he's lying low for his own protection, perhaps waiting for the political dust to clear in Iraq, waiting for the Americans to depart. He's certainly going to be a very, very important figure. And, of course, his views are rather radical compared to Imam Musa al-Sadr, some of the other Sadrs. Just to emphasize the range and variety in this family, I've included one more Sadr, who I ran across really by accident. I don't know if you can see him. His picture's not that great. I took it, so my apologies. This is Sayyid Muhammad Sadr. He's a cousin of Muqtada al-Sadr. He's a former Iranian deputy foreign minister under the reformists, under Hatemi, and he was an unsuccessful candidate for the Iranian parliament in 2008. Very liberal gentleman. So you can see the views differ, although if you can see his chubby face, he has the same face as Muqtada al-Sadr. So obviously they're related. Shiism, as this audience I'm sure knows, is a religion in which the followers get to choose which marja, or source of emulation, to follow. And Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is not the supreme leader of most of the world's Shiites. That position is held by Ali Sistani, who is Iranian-born but has lived in Najaf for half a century. And in Qum, I interviewed Sistani's son-in-law, This is Sayed Javad Sharistani. He has been in Qom since 1977. Interestingly, he's not been back to Iraq since the toppling of Saddam Hussein. He said he stays in Iran for security reasons. He also stays there because he manages Sistani's infrastructure of libraries, seminaries, clinics, you name it. They have a huge infrastructure in Iran. That's where they collect most of the money for the entire operation. And Sharistani was very interesting. He said, look, you know, speaking to me in fluent Persian, he said, Iran and Iraq are not the same. There are major differences even between the Shia of these two countries. And he compared the Shia of Iran and the Shia of Iraq to Germans and British. He said, you know, we're not the same. You should keep this in mind. Showing again the variety within the movement, I was in Beirut in March, and I interviewed this gentleman, Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah. I mentioned him earlier. He was a contemporary of Bakr al-Sadr. He was also contemporary of Khomeini. And he told me that he rejects the notion of veliyat-e faqih. He does not believe that a religious leader should have ultimate power and indefinite power in a society over the secular affairs of society. He also made it clear that he considers himself the superior of Khamenei and the equal, if not the superior, of Ayatollah Khomeini. He said, Ayatollah Khomeini had a lot of respect for me. So, to sum up on the mullahs, Iran's ability to project power, even among fellow Shiites, is aided by historic and blood ties between clerics, but it's constrained by sectarian and ethnic divisions and the nature of the Shiite religion. Shiism is not a monolith, and Iran's supreme leader faces competition from a number of figures whose allegiance is not primarily to him or to the Iranian state. Now let's go to the money. At various times and with various groups, Iranian financial aid has been very important. But I would argue that it's less important to some extent now than it was before. Many of Iran's partners have substantial resources, and the relationships between Iran and its partners have changed over time. I interviewed a number of people in the Middle East trying to figure out how much money Hezbollah gets from Iran. This is a subject of great contention. The figures that I heard range from $100 million a year to $100 million a month. A lot of this money comes from Iranian foundations and charities. It's not transparent. There really is absolutely no way to know for sure. Only Hassan Nasrallah knows for sure. I think what's important here is not so much the amount, but the way in which this money is spent. In Hezbollah, Iran has created the template for the modern Islamic fundamentalist organization, a complete package of ideology, religion, military prowess, and social services. I went to an example of this. This is, go to the next. This is a slide from the Rasul al-Azam Hospital. It means the Greatest Prophet Hospital. It's in the southern suburbs of Beirut, which are known as the Dahya. And I call this is my Shiite Madonna. I took a picture of this lady with her kid in the pediatric ward, if you can see, of the Rasul al-Azam Hospital. It was founded in the late 1980s by Iran's Martyrs Foundation. This is a parastatal organization that Khomeini created during the Iran-Iraq War. And the Martyrs Foundation continually upgrades Rasul al-Azam. It has state-of-the-art technology, has the first open MRI in Lebanon, a very nice neonatal unit, a new school for nursing, a 200-bed cardiac hospital that's going to open next year. It treats about 200,000 patients a year, most of whom pay only minimal charges, and care is free for the families of martyrs, Hezbollah members who die in the line of duty. I also visited a place called Al-Wad, which means the promise. And this was a company set up by Hezbollah after the war with Israel in 2006 to rebuild 37,000 housing units destroyed by Israeli bombing. If you want to go back one, this is the Dahya, the southern suburbs, in March. As you can see, there's still a lot of rubble. They had really barely begun their reconstruction work. If you want to go to the next one, though. The head of Al-Wad, this gentleman here, Hassan Jishi, he's an architect, Lebanese architect, he said that displaced families got about $53,000 each from the Lebanese government, and that 70% of these families decided to turn the money over to Hezbollah, over to Al-Wad, for reconstruction. And it's ironic because most of the money originally came from Saudi Arabia, which is no friend of Hezbollah, no friend of Iran, and yet Hezbollah and Iran, by extension, got the credit for this work. Residents of the Dahya have more faith in Hezbollah to rebuild honestly and competently. And this slide, if you can see, this is a mock-up of what the Dahya is going to look like after the reconstruction. The promise, the Wad, is to build it back better than it was before. I mentioned that the Saudis gave a lot of money for reconstruction. For Hezbollah per se, there's a lot of money that comes from wealthy Lebanese Shia who are no longer as downtrodden as they used to be. In fact, it's been argued now that the Sunnis are a more downtrodden community in some ways than the Shia of Lebanon. There's also a very large and very wealthy Lebanese Shia diaspora. And Nicholas Ngo, who's a young Beirut-based expert on Hezbollah, says that he thinks Hezbollah now gets more money from this Shiite diaspora than it does from Iran. Partly this is a function of what happened in the 1990s. The Iranians drastically cut back on support for Hezbollah in the 1990s because they needed money for their own reconstruction after the Iran-Iraq war. And also the price of oil was as low as $12 a barrel, so it put a little crimp in their ability to support outside groups. So this is when the Shia diaspora stepped up. Sheikh Fadlallah told me that he spends more than $5 million a year on his own religious charities, and that all of this money comes from Khums, religious taxes. None of it comes from Iran. Now, there have been similar assertions of independence from Shiite leaders in Iraq, including Sistani, who is the richest marja in the world. Clearly, he is able to collect enormous sums, doesn't need Iran's help. Also, the Hakim family, which is in charge of Skiri Iski, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, now the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. They claim that they're not getting money from Iran. I'm not sure if that's true, but they say they're also getting money from Homs. And people who run the organization of the Martyr Sadr, which was set up for Muqtada al-Sadr's murdered father, also claim to be getting their money independently. Again, it's unclear whether Iran has been helping. Iran has been quite open about its financial aid to the Maliki government, but the sums involved are minuscule compared to U.S. aid. The United States government has spent $45 billion on humanitarian reconstruction aid in Iraq since 2003. Iran, at least according to we know from the public figures, has offered a couple of billion dollars in soft loans. It's involved in some power plant and pipeline construction. So at least in terms of humanitarian aid, it's been really a pittance. And given the price of oil, Iraq really doesn't need and should not need economic aid from anybody. It should be able to now, as Paul Wolfowitz once famously said in 2003, it ought to be able to finance its own reconstruction now. I think where Iranian cash has been pivotal is with Hamas. And here I'll bring in the Palestinian group. As you know, in 2006, Hamas won Palestinian legislative elections. And as its reward, everyone cut it off. The Gulf Arabs, the Saudis, stopped giving money, and Hamas was desperate to meet salaries to pay for services. And the Iranians very nicely offered to step in. Again, we don't have exact figures, but Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh was caught in December of 2006 trying to smuggle $35 million in suitcases into Gaza from Egypt, and apparently a lot of this money came from Iran. However, this is a link of very recent duration, and I'll return to this when I talk about the militias. So, I mean, to sum up, Iran has provided crucial financial help at times to Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iraqi Shiite groups. But all of these organizations have or had other sources of funds and would survive, albeit not as well, without Iranian money. Now we come to the militias. And I think this topic is also a little bit more nuanced than the way in which it's sometimes presented in this town in particular. Starting with Hezbollah. There would be no Hezbollah without Iran. In the early 1980s and 1982, Iran sent 1,500 members of the Revolutionary Guard to the Bekaa Valley and organized Hezbollah from three groups primarily, Dawa, Islamic Amal, and the Lebanese Union of Muslim Students. This was after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. If you look at Hezbollah's pronouncements starting in 1985 when Hezbollah proclaimed itself in an open letter. The language could have been written in Tehran. It's absolutely indistinguishable, although a Hezbollah think tanker I interviewed insisted, no, it was written by a Lebanese. Well, it was written by a Lebanese who had channeled Ayatollah Khomeini. Officially, Hezbollah still regards Khamenei as its superior, as its supreme leader, and one of Khamenei's representatives sits on Hezbollah's consultative council. Over the years, however, Hezbollah really has evolved into a partner, not a proxy. And, you know, it's very interesting. I interviewed Iranian officials about Hezbollah and Hezbollah officials about Iran. And Iranians told me that they see Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader, as more charismatic, more decisive than their own supreme leader. I mean, this was off the record, needless to say, but there is a huge case of Nasrallah envy in Iran. They said, and the Hezbollah people also said, that Nasrallah makes the key tactical decisions in terms of Lebanon and in regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And Ali Fayyad, who heads a Hezbollah think tank in Beirut, says the relationship really is a two-way street now. So Nasrallah decided in 2006 to kidnap Israeli soldiers, touching off a 34-day war. Nasrallah, not the Iranians, decided to occupy West Beirut briefly last month after the Sinjar government threatened Hezbollah's communications network. If you listened to or read a speech that Hassan Nasrallah gave last month on the 8th anniversary of the Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon, you heard a kind of Nasser-like figure with pan-Arab aspirations. I mean, he talked about Israel, he talked about Iraq, someone far more authoritative on these issues than Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who I have decided is a Nasrallah wannabe. Clearly, the military ties are important, and we saw this in a very interesting way in February when Imad Mughniyeh was assassinated. This person was Iran's liaison, really, to Hezbollah, a master terrorist. These are photographs, posters of him in Beirut. There are also similar posters of him in Tehran now, all over the place, which is kind of ironic since neither Iran nor Hezbollah admitted his existence or his role before he was killed in Damascus, presumably by the Israelis. Now, his role was important, and the connection, of course, the military connection was tremendously important. If we go to the next slide. It is clear from many sources that Iran has rearmed Hezbollah since 2006. The Israeli government says that Hezbollah now has 40,000 rockets compared to 12,000 in 2006. I don't know quite how they know this, but this is what they say. I think you still have to assume that Hezbollah would be a formidable force, even if Iran were to cut back now on supplies. There was some interruption in supplies. I've compared it, and others have, to the relationship between the United States and Israel. It's not a comparison some people like to make, but if the United States were to stop giving Israel $3 billion a year in military aid, it would certainly be very difficult for Israel, but Israel would survive. It's got substantial resources now of its own, a very strong economy, support from a Jewish diaspora, and Israel certainly would manage. And Hamas clearly would also exist without Iran. I read a very interesting paper that was put out by the Israeli government that notes that most of Hamas's weapons are either homemade or were inherited from the Palestinian Authority when Hamas took over Gaza last year. So some weapons perhaps are getting in, but even with the difficulties of monitoring those tunnels, you know, that go from Egypt to Gaza, still most of, very few of the weapons really are coming from Iran to Hamas. Now, in Iraq, the picture is a little bit different. If we are to believe the Pentagon, and I'm going to put forward what they say and give it credence, Iran has played a very destructive and devious role in Iraq. It has supplied explosives that have killed hundreds of Americans and thousands of Iraqis. If not for Iran, I've been told by very high-level U.S. officials, the Sadr forces would have great difficulty shelling the green zone with impunity. Apparently, some of these rockets do indeed come from Iran. And Iran seems to have an ability to calibrate the level of violence, to turn it up or turn it down, depending on political developments in Iraq and also Iran's attitude toward the United States over other issues such as the nuclear issue. And there have been, I think, credible reports of Iranian training for Iraqi militias. In May, I was able to interview some very authoritative U.S. military officials, and they say that most of this training is going on in Iran. As of May, the end of May, there were about 10 Iranians in U.S. Or Iraqi custody in Iraq. There were 6,000 members of the Mahdi Army who allegedly had had training or received weapons from Iran, and about 200 members of so-called special units or renegade Shiite groups. And as to why Iran would be doing this, I defer to Ken Katzman, my mentor and hero, who told me that the Iranians want to maintain leverage, especially as its old allies in the Iraqi government, in the Supreme Council, Skiri Iski, become increasingly integrated now into the Iraqi armed forces and police. However, Iranians that I interviewed in March told me that their preference is still for Skiri Iski, the Hakims, to come out on top. They are arming Sadr, but they don't really like him. Sadr, they say, is no Nasrallah. And if the Hakim family falters, if they're unable to maintain their very important role now in Iraq, then Iran will have leverage through its support for Sadr in the special groups, but they would rather that the Hakims stay on top. So we can talk about, I'm sure panelists will talk about this, and we'll have some questions about these relationships, but I thought I would just conclude with four observations, some of them fairly obvious. First, Iran is obviously far more powerful than it was 7 years ago, largely due to U.S. actions. Getting rid of the Taliban government, overthrowing Saddam, but I think also to Iranian nimbleness in exploiting power vacuums, using its pre-existing relationships with various Arab militant groups in order to move in and take advantage of the vacuums created by U.S. policies. Second, though, and very importantly, Iran does face still internal and external constraints to expanding its influence in the region. Looking at the internal constraints, the economic situation in Iran is poor, despite the obscene price of oil. This is largely due to Ahmadinejad's economic mismanagement. He's failed to deliver on promises of more widespread prosperity, and he could even be forced to step aside and not run for president when Iran has presidential elections next year. People are lining up to run against him. There's a lot of resentment in Iran for money spent on Arab causes, and that's how Iranians view it. It's a little bit like Americans who are upset that the U.S. is spending $10, $12 billion a month on Iraq and Afghanistan. They want the money spent at home. And while there are religious Iranian Shia who go to Najaf and Karbala for pilgrimage, the affinity between Iranians and Arabs, even Arab Shia, is really not that great. Most Iranians, if given a chance to go abroad, will go to Dubai, where there are 500,000 other Iranians and where the shopping is great and they can drink and they don't have to wear a headscarf. Most Lebanese Shia that I have met would rather go to Paris than go to Tehran. this is a real limit, I think, on Iran's ability. And you see all these hysterical reports of little Tehrans appearing all over the place. I don't think so. I think it's a limited phenomenon and one that with smart U.S. policy doesn't necessarily have to continue. Another very important external constraint is the U.S. military, which, while under obvious stress and strain, is not about to leave the Middle East. Again, an obvious, I think a really quite obvious point, that a reduction in U.S.-Iran tensions would make it easier to find solutions to all the various problems in the region. Because Iran is a factor in all of these disputes, and Iran acts as a spoiler when it's upset at the United States. It finds a way to get back at the United States through its various partners. I think it's fair to say that Bush administration efforts to promote democracy have backfired by empowering Iranian-backed groups, and U.S. efforts to build a kind of coalition, create an alliance of Israel and the Sunni Arab states against Iran, it hasn't worked. Iran has emerged stronger, and so have Iranian partners. And then finally, a very small recommendation. I don't like to make recommendations as a journalist, but I was told I had to. If you write a special report, you have to. So a very obvious recommendation. U.S. should talk to Iran and should also put out feelers to Hamas and Hezbollah. These are important players in the region, and you're not going to be able to find solutions any other way. In my book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, I quote Richard Armitage, the former Deputy Secretary of State, who said that, you know, talking to your enemy is not appeasement. It depends on what you say and what you do. He said, quote, "Diplomacy is the art of letting the other guy have our way." classic Armitage-y. So I would also argue that the U.S. does have leverage. I know Condoleezza Rice has sometimes said that the U.S. is lacking leverage. We don't have leverage. We do. Particularly over the economy, the U.S. sanctions, the banking sanctions have hurt. Iran desperately needs investment, particularly in its gas sector, to exploit its gas reserves, and we do definitely have cards to play. So I'll leave it there, and we'll turn to the rest of the panel. Thank you.
Many thanks, Barb. We'll start off with the discussants with Kenneth Katzman, and in the meantime, there are a number of seats down front if some of those who are standing in back want to come forward and take a seat.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. there's not a lot to really disagree with in Barbara's paper.
I'm trying.
But I think I would put some different emphasis on some things she said. And the net effect will be probably much different. The Shias throughout the Islamic world, in my view, see themselves as the oppressed, the mustadafin, as they call it. As such, I see another source of Iranian influence, which is this revolutionary contact. The idea that the Shias are the oppressed, they have to plot clandestinely, they have to get together clandestinely and hide and plot, and this creates bonds as well. I think not enough was stressed about Iran's ability to work across sectarian lines, although it was discussed. I very much agree that Iran's emotional connections are with Shiite groups such as Hezbollah than with, for example, Sunni groups such as Hamas. However, let's also look at Iran's arms shipments to the Taliban, which were highlighted actually in the recent State Department report on terrorism. And I think we can get maybe broader conclusions about Iran's intentions and its goals. Let's also recall Iran's high-profile efforts in 1993-94. To train militants of all stripes in Sudan when Hassan al-Turabi was at the height of his power in Sudan. Essentially, it's important to ask ourselves, what is Iran's strategy? To my mind, Iran's goals are not exclusively defensive. Iran wants absolute security, particularly from the United States, and sees its support to these various factions as a way to hold countervailing leverage against the United States. It sees a nuclear weapon as an even more effective countervailing form of leverage, in my view. But I think Iran's goals are broader than this. I still see Iran as basically a revolutionary power, although it recognizes its constraints and limitations. But basically, it wants to overturn and end what Iran sees as the domination of the Middle East by the United States and Israel. In Iran's view, the United States and Israel control the outcomes. They keep the Shias down. They control the economics. They control U.S. policy. Iran believes Israel controls U.S. policy. The two, in combination, eliminate any challenges to their hegemony. And Iran, in my view, is looking to overturn this power structure, really. Iran has no time frame for achieving this. In the early years after the revolution, Iran made an all-out push to force the issue. It supported revolutionary Shiite movements in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain. Bahrain has openly twice accused Iran of trying to organize a coup d'etat in Bahrain. Iran, as Barbara noted, helped form Hezbollah's military and terrorist wing. Basically, Hezbollah was the Dawa party. Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq is from the Dawa party. Well, Hezbollah in Lebanon was formed from the very same Dawa party that Mohammed Bakr Sadr had theorized and had formed in 1957. However, Iran quickly realized that trying to force the issue by supporting these radical and terrorist and militant movements caused a backlash. Saudi Arabia broke relations with Iran in 1987, and the Gulf states welcomed the United States into the Gulf. So Iran's strategy was actually having a backlash effect, and actually the opposite effect of what Iran wanted to achieve. Militarily, and I think Barbara didn't mention the U.S. military leverage here, Iran was severely shaken by the War of the Cities during the Iran-Iraq War, the tanker war, the U.S. tanker reflagging program, and particularly Operation Praying Mantis in April 1988, where the United States Navy sunk almost half of Iran's fleet, naval fleet, in approximately 3 hours. And Iran, I believe, has a very healthy respect for U.S. military capabilities. I know Barbara knows we disagree a little bit on this. Iran obviously has some military options, but let's remember, the United States Navy sunk 4 Japanese aircraft carriers at the Battle of Midway in 1942. I think we can handle a few Iranian patrol boats, quite frankly. After expending much energy and ending the 1980s bankrupt, exhausted, militarily defeated, and isolated, Iran adopted a much more patient strategy to achieve absolute security and this overturning of the power structure. Iran began to revive or start this slow and steady drive toward a nuclear weapon and more patient strategy of expanding its influence, not trying to force the issue, but as Barbara said, take advantage of opportunities when the United States, Israel, and others slipped up, left a power vacuum, made mistakes. For example, Iran was so lacking in confidence that it did not attack the Taliban in September 1998. It mobilized tanks, but did not enter into Afghanistan, even though the Taliban had killed 9 Iranian diplomats in Mazar-e Sharif. However, as soon as al-Qaeda attacked the Trade Center, the September 11 attacks, and the U.S. then moved to take out the Taliban. So Iran, we did Iran's work, essentially, for it. And Iran was so clever that it continued to build ties to the ousted Taliban and are now using that as a source of leverage against us. Iran took advantage of Israel's decision to retain a decade-long security zone in South Lebanon, which had the net effect of allowing Hezbollah to remain armed, keep its military wing, and it obviously claimed credit for forcing Israel to withdraw in 2000, claimed a victory in the 2006 Israel-Hezbollah war. And Iran, through these mistakes, through some of these Israeli shortcomings, Hezbollah is obviously emerged perhaps even on top in the Lebanese power structure now. Similarly, in the case of Hamas, although Hamas has many different sources of funds and arms, Iran benefited by Hamas's victory in the January 2006 election, which was a product of Fatah corruption, as well as the Israel and the Bush administration's refusal to engage Fatah and when Arafat was alive in final status negotiations. At the same time, Iran has taken advantage of the U.S. decision to isolate Syria. Iran is investing in Syria's economy, cooperating with it to supply Hezbollah. Israel, to its credit, is now trying to drive a wedge between the two by reviving prospects for a Israeli-Syrian peace treaty. It is clearly in Iraq that Iran has benefited most, in which the U.S. and its allies have miscalculated. The overthrow of Saddam has basically, in my view, turned Iraq over in many ways to Iran. And indeed, the overthrow of Saddam has paved the way for the completion of the Shia Islamic revolution in Iraq that Khomeini, Bakr Sutter, Fadlallah, and these other clerics had always envisioned. They envisioned envisioned victory in Iraq before coming to power in Iran. It happened the opposite way, but now the cycle is completed in many ways. The U.S. occupation stirred up opposition from displaced Sunnis, which in turn gave the Shias an excuse to expel many Sunnis out of Baghdad and grow their militias. And now the U.S. is institutionalizing Iranian influence by supporting Maliki without question, who himself relies very heavily on Tehran's advice. At the same time, Iran has handled its own dilemma in Iraq because its Shia proteges are now fighting each other. So Iran is a little bit off balance in Iraq, but Iran is maintaining that, trying to balance it by arming, obviously, Muqtada Sadr's faction, keeping him going as leverage against the United States, and also making sure that Maliki and Hakim do not eliminate him from the power structure either. and the Sadr faction is well positioned to fight the United States. If there is a U.S.-Iran confrontation, the Sadr faction could be activated. We heard about the rocketry to the Green Zone, explosively forced projectiles, etc. In the Gulf, and just to conclude, Iran has largely backed off from aggressive action, preferring instead to keep the Gulf states somewhat neutral as Iran develops its nuclear program. However, I think we should have no illusions that if an opportunity presents itself, Iran might get active there. Bahrain is perhaps the most vulnerable, since it does have a Shiite majority and has experienced periodic unrest against the Sunni-dominated minority government. An Iranian breakthrough anywhere in the Gulf would complicate U.S. efforts to easily move ships and forces up and down the Gulf and reduce U.S. ability to counter any Iranian effort to close off the Strait of Hormuz. But in general, I think it's in the military sphere where Iran has the least leverage and where the United States has the most leverage. And I think U.S. policymakers, need to highlight that more. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenneth. Mona?
Thank you, and good morning. I think my presentation is going to be a little bit more boring. No fireworks here, because I really think Barbara's paper is excellent, and I want to start by saying I think it makes a very important contribution toward furthering our understanding of a highly, I would say, complex and opaque subject. By putting Iran's role vis-a-vis actors, in particular in Lebanon and Iraq, into both a political and historical context. The paper also, I think, provides important empirical data so that we can at least begin to gauge the extent of Iran's influence in Lebanon and elsewhere. I would also concur with Barbara's conclusions and in particular endorse the need for U.S.-Iran dialogue as a means of reducing tensions in the region, particularly in Lebanon. Let me, by way of agreement, actually amplify a few of the points made in the paper with respect to Lebanon and then maybe conclude with a question to put out on the table. Essentially, I think what's important about this paper is that it does inject what I would say much-needed nuance into this question of Iran's role in Lebanon by highlighting some of the differences between Iran and Lebanon and by underscoring, I think most importantly, that Hezbollah's militants are not mere proxies and that this is, in fact, a relationship that has evolved. I think it's a common misconception in the West that's often played up, in particular by Hezbollah's detractors in Lebanon, as a means of gaining greater Western support. I was in Beirut in early May, just before everything exploded, and spoke to a number of people, including members of parliament from the March 14th faction, which is in the majority of the government, in opposition to Hezbollah. And with all that was happening internally in Lebanon, all the difficulties, all the problems that the parties need to face up to and contend with, the discussion was focused largely on how Lebanon is threatened to become the tip of a nuclear-armed spear of Iran, threatening not just Lebanon, but indeed the entire Mediterranean region. I think this kind of exaggeration of Iran's threat, Iran's presence in Lebanon, is to the detriment of those of us seeking to understand the region and to the detriment of seeking policy solutions that will bring about greater peace and stability. And so I think this notion of, as Barbara, I think, cogently explains in the paper, the evolution of the relationship toward a partnership rather than Hezbollah simply a proxy is an important one. And that really leads to my second point, which is, again, to focus a bit on the constraints that are faced in the case of Iran externally with respect to its influence in a place like Lebanon. The paper underscores the limits of applying Iran's theocratic system of velayat-e faqih in a place like Lebanon with its unique multi-confessional system. In my estimation, Hezbollah understands this fully, and they are not interested in dominating Lebanon's political system. They understand full well that in Lebanon, one sect cannot dominate all of the others. And I believe the Iranians probably by extension understand this. This, to my mind, would explain in part Hezbollah's behavior, again referencing back to the events of early May, in which Hezbollah, feeling that its arms arsenal was threatened, undertook and took over, essentially, West Beirut in a matter of hours, but then quickly turned control over of the parts of the city that it had taken over into the control of the army. They're not interested in a coup d'etat. They are not interested in imposing an Iranian-style theocracy on Lebanon. And here, again, this is where I would see the limits of Iran's revolutionary, if you want to call it that, ambitions. Third, again, to get back to this point, of because this sort of leads to my concluding question of Hezbollah's evolution from an Iranian-created, inspired terrorist militant organization to now one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, players in Lebanon today. Certainly, Hezbollah's weapons, its self-proclaimed status as leader of the resistance remain key and are critical to the movement. But at the same time, the movement has laid down significant roots within Lebanon's Shiite community, providing a vast network of education, health, and other social services in the absence of a strong central Lebanese government. And again, I think the paper does an excellent job of documenting some of this. Beyond the fact that they have this deeply embedded grassroots network, Hezbollah has also cultivated an image of being clean, of not being corrupt as many of Lebanon's other leaders are perceived to be, and also of being competent. And here I think Barbara's example of Al-Wa'd and the notion of people choosing to turn money over given to them by the Lebanese government to Hezbollah for reconstruction, I think suggests very clearly that they're putting their trust and confidence in Hezbollah's competence as opposed to the state. I think it's also important, though, that in the paper it is pointed out that there are lots of questions and that we are dealing with a murky situation with respect to funding, that it is very opaque. It is as far from transparent as we can get, and that's important. These are important issues that still remain to be understood. My concluding thought and sort of the preface to my question is essentially in the paper, Barbara talks about Nasrallah as being Iran's wunderkind, which I love. It's a great phrase. And, you know,
It's Simon Caron, the former Lebanese ambassador to the U.S., called him Iran's wunderkind.
That's terrific. But clearly, I think Hezbollah faces numerous challenges going forward. The Doha Agreement, assuming it holds and that Lebanon doesn't descend into civil war, may represent a short-term victory for Hezbollah and, by extension, I suppose, Iran. But I think there are numerous long-term challenges. And to me, they raise questions about the extent to which, over the long term, there may be increasing tensions or differences between Hezbollah and its interests and Iran's agenda. In terms of the challenges that Hezbollah needs to face, I would lay out three. One is, a very important one, repairing the damage done to its credibility and reputation for having turned its arms on fellow Lebanese, a promise that it had made long ago that it would never turn its arms on its fellow Lebanese citizens. This calls into question the entire notion of Hezbollah as a resistance force and brings into question the role of its arms. Second, and I think this affects Iran as well, the rise in sectarianism in Lebanon, and in particular deepening tensions between the Shia community on the one hand and the Sunni on the other. Lebanon is continuing to be racked by violence, most recently in the past few days in Tripoli, fairly extensive, heavy fighting in Tripoli between Sunni and Shia forces there, or Alawi forces aligned with the Syrians. And third, I think it is not in Hezbollah's interest, nor is it in Iran's interest, for Lebanon to descend into an all-out civil war. And I think this is another challenge that they must contend with. Now, assuming that Hezbollah is able to deal with these, what I would call sort of Lebanon-centric challenges, I think there are also broader regional challenges to Hezbollah, which we've touched on. certainly the notion of peace between Israel and Syria, and what does, how does Hezbollah respond? By extension, what does that mean for Iran? I would contend that it would bring Hezbollah even closer to Iran as a result. But I also think, and here's where my question comes in finally, that over time, Hezbollah is going to be faced with critical choices as to its ultimate destiny. Will it evolve into a significant political player in the Lebanese arena, or will it further entrench itself as an armed militia? Which way Hezbollah evolves is a question. It remains, to my mind, uncertain. But the uncertainty itself, I think, raises the possibility that should Hezbollah opt to evolve into more of a Lebanese political player and integrate itself more fully into the Lebanese political arena, and there are already measures in place for Hezbollah to do that. It will have a blocking third in the unity government, should it be formed. It's certain to win a number of seats in forthcoming parliamentary elections. I think at this point, it may begin to find that its interests no longer coincide as closely with those of Iran, and that this may inject an element of tension into the relationship. So that's kind of where I would leave it. The question of whether and where differences between Iran's agenda and Hezbollah's interests may crop up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mona. We turn to Dan Brumberg.
Well, it's hard to follow up all these excellent presentations with something new and exciting and innovative. I'm just going to offer a few comments. When I was looking at the slide on the rehabilitation of this neighborhood in Beirut, it began to look a bit to me like Co-op City in the Bronx. I hope it's, that's not going to be the outcome, because if it is, Hezbollah's popularity should decline rapidly after that. With all due respect to the Bronx, a place where I spent a lot of time in my youth. And it also occurred to me when Ken was talking that the Allies had fantastic intelligence during the Battle of Midway. If we had that kind of intelligence on Iran, we'd probably be in better shape. But let's focus on the subjects at hand. I have two sets of related comments. First of all, I think it's not, and I'm going to say some things are going to echo and some of the things that Ken said here. I think the paper, Barbara's paper, is wonderful in outlining the constraints. I would also emphasize the many incentives that Iran has to pursue its policies and how difficult it is for Iran to change its own behavior. I think it's, as we say in political science, this is very path-dependent. It has a long history, and part of it is the history of the revolution itself. Iran's foreign policy is in part an expression of the nature of Iranian politics and the role of revolutionary ideology, and the role of supporting charismatic leaders, and the role of being anti-Western, and the role of being anti-Israel, and the role of being anti-United States. And it's often the case when we're trying to evaluate international relations and foreign policy issues that we try to minimize ideology, or we simply attribute ideology to some other thing, to some other problem. And we don't attribute to it the kind of role it has in formulating the worldview and the motivations and the objectives of players. In the case of Iran, Iran is not an ordinary state in that sense. It's a state in which ideology still plays a role, and not only ideology, or kind of revolutionary ideology, but an ideology that has a constituency that Ahmadinejad has plugged into very successfully, a constituency with economic and political and institutional interests. It's not a matter of just a revolutionary ideology hanging there in the clouds and the atmosphere. It has institutional foundations. And it's important, in some sense, for the Islamic State to exist as the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is what the reformists found out. You can't abandon the ideology. You have to recharge it. You have to recharge your batteries every X number of years. You have to have these international alliances that really help to cement the political apparatus of the Islamic Revolution itself at home. So there's an organic, ideological, and institutional relationship between the Iranian state as a revolutionary state and its foreign policy. And when the reformists, in the good old days, and that's when I was in Iran last, I haven't gotten there since the bad old days began, it was clear from the reformers found out that as soon as they engage in proposing changes in the nature of Iran's relationship with the United States, the reason why they pay such a heavy price is because they are beginning to undermine the very foundations of the Islamic Republic. And that's unacceptable. And so this is an organic institutional ideological link that has been re-energized. Ahmadinejad may be a wannabe. I've seen Nasrallah live in Iran, and I tell you, he gives the best speech I've ever seen. And I heard him. I heard his entire speech when I was in Cairo a few weeks ago. I listened to the entire thing. It was a wonderful performance. So Ahmadinejad may be no Nasrallah, but Nasrallah, in some sense, evinces the ideological thrust that the Iranians want. They need him.
Sort of like Tony Blair to George Bush, yeah?
I won't go there. But they need him because, in some sense, he evinces... I mean, Nasrallah is a kind of legacy of Khomeini, in some sense. And it's important for... And it's very hard there for Iran, as I was saying, in terms of the incentives. The incentives and the constraints. It's hard for Iran to turn back from because this is part of how they operate as a state. And it's not easy to crack that nut. It's not easy to address that problem in the context of U.S.-Iranian relations, but in the context of Iran's relationship with the Arab world and the broader Muslim world. This brings me to my second set of comments. I'll try to make this very brief. And that is, in this context of supporting or re-energizing its revolutionary ideology, it's important for Iran to support revolutionary movements, both Shia and Sunni, but preferably Shia. There's a very close link here. And revolutionary movements that are movements and not first and most political parties, but movements, have an ideology, have charismatic leaders, and who principally, and this is the point I would like to emphasize here, question the legitimacy of states. Question the legitimacy of states. And this is the great paradox of the Islamic Revolution. Khomeini institutionalized the revolution, but it never lost the kind of revolutionary sort of identity which questions the question of order, questions the role of the state. And in supporting revolutionary movements of one kind or the other, Hamas, Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq, Hezbollah in Lebanon, you get that kind of linkage. And this is very important for Iran to do. Now, the United States looked at that problem and said that this is a security problem for the United States. How are we going to address it? We're going to address it by what I call the inside-out approach. We're going to have regime change in Iran. Regime change in Iraq, and then a regime change in Iran. We're going to have a democratic revolution in Lebanon. And, of course, as Ken and others have said, that backfired. That only strengthened the Iranian hand. And now we have to look at sort of the outside-in question about how you address the regional political order. We have a working group on at the USAP. We had just a wonderful discussion about this with Mona the other day. How do you address the regional issue? What has happened, and here, Ken, you were quite right about this, what we've seen the last few years is not only has Iran supported revolutionary movements, but in part, paradoxically, as a consequence of Israeli decisions to withdraw from Lebanon, to withdraw from Gaza, movements have been strengthened at the expense of states and state authority. Instead of Israel having a process of negotiation with state leaders and making concessions and rewarding states and state sovereignty, Israel unilaterally withdrew, handing over victories to revolutionary movements or charismatic movements supported by Iran. This all happened, much of this happened before the whole Iraq question. Yeah. It began. And in fact, in Lebanon, of course, let's not forget that the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran began when Rabin deposited 400 Islamists into southern Lebanon. This has been going on for a while. This talk about, you know, a process of talk about something that's backfiring. So what we have here is a process by which, as a consequence of not treating the regional order and not addressing peace issues and not promoting a peace process by which states negotiate with states, but instead supporting a process of withdrawal with reinforced charismatic revolutionary movements, Iran's hand has been greatly strengthened. And I'll leave it on this note. The question is, you know, what can you do? Having the inside-outside approach has failed. Can we address the outside sort of approach, the outside regional architecture question, in effective ways now? And that's not clear. Will a Syrian-Israeli deal, which we would have been better off having X years ago, will that in some sense address the Iranian question in ways that really address and undermine the Iranian influence? The only, as far as I'm concerned, the only way to address this problem is by promoting a process of peacemaking between Israel and its neighbors that really helps to restructure the regional environment and return the primacy of states. But I would suggest to you that ultimately a group like Hezbollah is very ambivalent about the notion of Lebanese sovereignty in the Lebanese state. I think that if you look closely at what Nasrallah said 3 weeks ago, and he wants to have his cake and eat it too. He praises Lebanon, but he also suggests that he's behind Fethullah Gulen. This is not somebody who I suggest can be trusted, because it's not simply a matter of one person, one charismatic leader, one individual. It's the nature of the revolutionary movement he supports. And we can't. The only way to address that challenge is by addressing the regional order question, by the whole question of the peace process, by changing the constraints and changing the incentives that face Iran and its allies in ways that will really compel Iran to rethink what it's doing. Right now, we've played our cards in the opposite direction, that is, reinforce Iran's leverage and reinforce the revolutionary movements. I would even suggest, by the way, that Hamas has real clear ambivalence about the sovereignty of a Palestinian state, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest Bakr Sadr has that as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dan. Before we open it to the audience, and we will have those who have questions line up at the two sides, I'd like to turn to Barb and just give her an opportunity if there's anything in particular she'd like to respond to from what the discussants have had to say. She's laid out quite a panorama of issues. The discussants have taken issue with her on a number of fronts, and we'll give her a chance to respond, and then we'll open up to the audience.
Thanks, Jenny. Thank you very much to my discussants. Very good observations. I think they really added a lot to the subject. Ken, I agree with you and I disagree with you. I think that the revolutionary ideology is important, was important, but having gone to Iran now seven times since 1996, you know, it's not a revolutionary. What the United States has done is sort of revived some of the revolutionary characteristics of the Iranian state that had really largely disappeared. I think the combination of U.S. policies, Israeli policies, the withdrawals and that have helped some of these groups, and also the high price of oil has revived some of this revolutionary ideology. But Iranians are not revolutionaries anymore, not even those who call themselves revolutionaries, not even Ahmadinejad. I mean, perhaps he more than the others. There is a hunger in that country to be accepted as a normal state, to be respected, to have a seat at the table, to be part of the regional order. And Iranian officials well understand that they cannot. I mean, maybe they can have their cake and eat it too for a while, but ultimately they're going to have to change their policies if they really want to be accepted as a major player in the region, as a legitimate player in the region. There was a wonderful comment from Adnan Abu Odeh, who's a former Jordanian ambassador to the UN and information minister and a former senior fellow at USIP, who said, you know, ultimately, he said, the Iranians will trade the Arabs for the United States because they want to survive. So if it comes to a deal, a point where they see tremendous benefits in economic terms, in terms of political prestige and so on, to make a deal with the U.S. and to change the nature of their relationship with these other organizations, they will do so. Now, it will help if, as Dan pointed out, we have peace processes going on that affect all these various issues, so that there's a reason for Hezbollah to turn over its weapons. There's a reason for Hamas to stop sending rockets into Israel. There's a reason for Syria to make a deal. You know, we have to approach all of this at once. We don't have the luxury of just picking off this or that. The whole notion that peace in the Middle East goes through Jerusalem, goes through Baghdad, goes through Tehran, it goes Damascus, it goes through all of these places, through Beirut, and we have to, I think, work on all of these issues at once. I agree, though, with Dan, it will be difficult for Iran to change its behavior. That's why, again, we have to work on all these issues at once. With Mona, I also agree that there's a short-term victory that Hezbollah and Iran have scored in Lebanon, but definitely there are long-term challenges. We had a discussion about this a couple of weeks ago. We talked about Iran's nervousness at what had happened in Beirut in May. Iran did not want to see a major Sunni-Shia war break out. Part of its ideology is that it's pan-Islamic, it's bigger than Shiism, it's not just Persian, it addresses all of the downtrodden of the world, and especially the downtrodden of the Muslim world. So if you get Sunni and Shia at each other's throats, this does not help the Iranians. It polarizes the region, when I was in Jordan, I didn't mention that part of it, but the Jordanians are absolutely paranoid now about Iranian influence there. I mean, I had Jordanians tell me that the Iranians would come and convert everyone to Shiism. I don't see it. I mean, the Shia are 10 to 15% of the world's Muslims. It's not going to happen. But people are very worried. They're very on edge. And the fighting that Mona mentioned that went on in Tripoli between Sunni and Shia, now you have very, very poor Sunni. You also have a radicalized Palestinian Sunni contingent, particularly in Lebanon in the camps, very Al-Qaeda influenced. Iran does not want to see a conflict between these people and between Hezbollah. So down the road, I would agree that there are a lot of constraints in that area as well. If I erred too much on the side of showing the constraints rather than the openings to influence, I think it was just to try to inject some balance into the debate in this town, because too often you just hear, strangely enough, from the same people who promoted the Iraq war, oh my God, the Iranians are you know, they're under the beds, the Iranians are coming, the Iranians are coming. Well, who gave them the opportunity? You did. But never mind, now we have to sort of focus on the next big enemy, which is Iran. So I just wanted to you know, lower the tone of the hysteria a little bit.
Thank you. If anyone has some questions or comments, I'd ask you to line up at the two mics on either side of the room and please identify yourself. While people are getting situated, I'll launch the first question, Barb, and ask you, how do you think the recent EU sanctions will impact the money flows mm-hmm. into and out of Iran?
Well, I didn't deal it, and if you want to, you know, this is sort of outside the scope of my paper. It's a paper, not a book. But I think they have had an impact. I think the banking sanctions definitely have had an impact, but not enough of an impact given the price of oil. With oil at the price that it is, and one might argue that the whole sanctions process has actually inflated the price of oil because of the perception that it will cause problems for the Iranians. Iran is going to small banks, small European banks, not the big ones. It's going to second-tier banks in Asia, Malaysia, Singapore, China. It's managing quite well, at least the elements of the economy that are most responsible for the behavior we don't like are managing quite well.
Okay. Let's start over here. We'll just alternate between the two.
Yes, hi. My name is Greg Aftandilian with CNO Resources. My question is for Barbara, maybe Dan, to talk about the internal factions within the regime of Iran and how that impacts on foreign policy decisions. Because, you know, people sometimes say there's Ahmadinejad on one side, then the sort of so-called pragmatic conservatives on the other. And I'm curious to see, get your take on how, if the pragmatic conservatives sort of wind up on top, in various power struggles, would the foreign policy be that much different than it is today? Or if you could just explain how you see those dynamics working. Thanks.
Well, I would. My guess is that if the pragmatic conservatives, and they're not a coherent or monolithic group in of themselves, but their numbers have enlarged over the last year or two as a result of defections from Ahmadinejad's camp to the pragmatic conservatives. Defections that have to do with economic interests, which is something that needs greater attention because they have real economic interests that have been undermined by the rise of Ahmadinejad and his allies, and by questions over tactics, real criticisms of Ahmadinejad's handling of the proliferation issue on the international stage in ways that brought about a concertation of interest between the U.S. and the Europeans that Ahmadinejad's critics say wouldn't have happened had he not couched his whole sort of approach to this in bombastic and threatening language. So I think that there are tactical and strategic differences, and the camp of pragmatic conservatives is strong. How strong, we're not really sure, but I think they're going to pose a real challenge. What would if their candidate Kalibaf or somebody else became president, I think it would change. It would affect, particularly on a tactical level, and the lines between tactics and strategy is often blurred. It would affect Iran's behavior on the proliferation issue, on the U.S. issue. It would, at least on a tactical level, evince a greater possibility for cooperation and compromise. I really do believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think we pointed out, of course, the reformers had different views when Hatemi was president. He tried to forge a relationship with the Lebanese government not just with Hezbollah. There was Iranian sort of aid to the Lebanese government. He tried to actually reinforce Lebanese sovereignty. And this was one of the reasons why Hezbollah decided it needed its own sources of money besides the Iranians. So you do see a different approach. His willingness, Hatemi's willingness to accept the two-state solution, the reformists always talked about not being more Palestinian than the Palestinians. If it was okay with the Palestinians, it would be okay with them. So that's on the reform side, and I think you hear some of that from the so-called pragmatic conservatives, although they need to be given a reason to reduce support. You know, in 2003, again, when the reformers were in power, there was a proposal for negotiations between the U.S. and Iran that I write about in my book, and one of the things that the Iranians agreed to talk about was turning Hezbollah and Hamas and so on into just political parties, not militant groups. So there could be a change, yeah.
Thank you.
Rendon Rahim, I'm a fellow at the Institute. I'm sorry, this is very high. I've got one comment and a question really to Barbara and then a broader one to the panel. Thanks very much. Great presentations. Barbara, I noticed that you did not, you talked about Hezbollah being, yes.
Thank you.
You talked about Hezbollah being a creature of Iran, or being, you know, the inception of Hezbollah being aided by Iran, but you didn't mention anything about Badr,
yeah,
the Iraqi militia. I don't know if it's in the paper. I'm sorry, I didn't actually, haven't read your paper. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the Supreme Council, Skiri, which is now Iski, which were created in Iran. And the broader question about that is, to what extent do these links, the mullahs, the money, the militias, and the role of Iran in the creation of these militias and these political parties, to what extent does it influence the politics and the strategies and the policies of these political parties and these militias, particularly as they are acquiring more and more a role of governance in their respective states, whether we're talking about Lebanon or Iraq, or Hamas in Gaza. In other words, they are in a position to make politics and make policies in their own region. So to what extent are those connections, do they make them not subject to Iran's total power, but at least influenced by Iranian interests and Iranian the Iranian agenda? And the broader issue is really about the question of whether Iran is a revolutionary state or is not. Is Iran acting defensively? Mm-hmm. A lot of people in Washington say that, well, the reason Iran behaves in the way it does is because it's so afraid of the United States. And the reason that Iran must have a presence in Iraq and must be an actor on the Iraqi scene is because it's countering U.S. presence and is afraid that the U.S. will use Iran as a springboard. As if the U.S. were to simply withdraw from Iraq, then the Iranians would also go home and everything would be fine. And I want to ask if it is possible to say that really Iran is now acting not as an Islamist Shia revolutionary power, but really is going back to the Shah's era, mm-hmm. to a conception of itself as a hegemonic power in the region, mm-hmm. irrespective of Shiism. Shiism becomes a tool. Mm-hmm. The revolution becomes a tool or a vehicle. But that the objective is not to spread Shiism, not to simply make the Shia powerful, mm-hmm. Or to spread revolutionary movements, but really to gain hegemonic power in the region. Is that a possible conception of how Iran sees itself? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Ren. Very good questions. In the paper, I do point out that the Badr Brigades, which is the militia formed by Skiri Iski, was also created by the Iranians in Iran when after Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980, many of the Shia, Iraqi Shia leaders fled to Tehran, and the Iranian government formed this militia in the similar way to which it had organized Hezbollah. But I think there is a parallel there, which is actually like the Hezbollah parallel, which is that as these groups come into power, become integrated into the governing structures of their various countries, they also draw back from the Iranians. And I interviewed some ISKI members in various places, I won't say where, and they were complaining bitterly about Iran supporting Sadr. Two ISKI governors in the south of Iraq were killed by Sadrists or special units, and probably using Iranian weapons. So they know that Iran is playing a double game or a triple game, mm-hmm. and they're very angry about it. And they are, Iraqis first. Just because you take help from someone, in fact, often when you do take help from someone, you tend to resent that person, not always love that person. It's, as we know from U.S. relationship with countries like Egypt and so on. So it's more complicated than that. Do they take Iran's interests into account? Absolutely. I think they understand that they cannot cross the Iranians, that they have to be very careful in the way they navigate between the United States and Iran. But they also understand that they have to be Iraqis, too, and they have to represent Iraqi interests. We see what Maliki has been doing and how much support he apparently has gotten for going against the Sadrists in some areas and the special units. So I think they're still Iraqis first, despite the concerns. On the question of Persian power, yeah, I think there's a lot to it. I think any Iranian I've ever met, if you scratch the surface, however Shia, however Islamic they may be, there's an Iranian underneath there. And they are really enjoying the sense that they're back and that Iran is back after all the difficulties that country has gone through. If you read books, I read a very good book by Shamran Shubin about foreign policy under the Shah, and there are many things in it that are absolutely valid today, the way Iran saw itself and so on, except that it saw itself as a small power in those days. Now I think it definitely sees itself as a regional power.
Can I just respond quickly? Sure. I think that there is a kind of false debate that we have to be aware of. That is, either Iran's foreign policy activities and motivations are generated by a realpolitik kind of rationality or a revolutionary one. Right. And if it's A, there are these conclusions. If it's B, it's both. Mm-hmm. And it's complex. Mm-hmm. And it's very, as far as I'm concerned, it's very different from the era of the Shah in that regard. You can't go back. It's not, they may be retrieving some version, but it's very different. The challenge for the United States is to find ways of decoupling these things. So the rational sort of realpolitik sort of calculation begins to triumph over the revolutionary ones. And what we've done is help to sort of re-energize mm-hmm. the revolutionary batteries. But the two go together in a very, and it's the quest for hegemony, if you like, or power of the region is, of course, greatly enhanced by its relationship with these revolutionary movements and by the magnification of the revolutionary ideological kind of a legacy of Khomeini. So the two are very closely related. Our challenge is to find ways to minimize one and strengthen the other calculation so we can have a rational set of interactions with the Iranians.
Can I just jump in quickly on the Lebanese aspect? It's a great question, and no doubt Iranian money and arms clearly has an influence on Hezbollah's politics, its policy, strategy. What I wanted to lay out is this notion that over time, as Hezbollah, by definition, becomes more integrated into the political arena, to what extent do these tensions then arise? And that is to say, to what extent does Hezbollah feel more constrained and more needing to respond to a Lebanese set of objectives and priorities as opposed to an Iranian one? And I do think those tensions will come up. I want to just maybe inject a question a little bit. I take Dan's point about Israel's withdrawal from South Lebanon empowering a movement, no question. But let's not forget that that also begins to remove the context or the pretext for resistance. And there are many who say, for example, that one needs to resolve the Sheba Farms issue as a means of removing a further pretext for Hezbollah's claims of being a resistance movement. I'm not going to be naive about this, but I do think to the extent that these pretexts, these issues of occupation are taken away, what do these movements have left, and do they not then need to integrate?
Mm-hmm. I just think it depends how you take these pretexts away.
Yeah,
I just wanted to basically second Dan Brumberg's view that there's not a big difference. I mean, to my mind, Iran sees the United States and Israel as hegemonic, and overthrowing or undoing that hegemony is revolutionary. Mm-hmm. They are revolutionary in the sense that they are trying to undo a status quo that they believe has kept them weak and subservient in their view, and they are striving to undo that status quo.
Okay, turn to
Stanley Carver with the Cato Institute. My question really follows this point. A few months ago, there was a flurry of activity between Egypt and Iran, delegations going back and forth. That seems to have stopped. Mm-hmm. And it appears that the principal issue of contention is the street in Tehran that is named after the assassin of Sadat. The Egyptians insist, and I think this is understandable, that street has to be renamed before they can go forward to diplomatic negotiations. The Iranians evidently are refusing to rename the street. Okay? So realpolitik versus revolutionary. If realpolitik dominated, it seems to me, they would rename the street. Mm-hmm. Paris is worth a mass. Relations with Egypt would seem to be worth renaming the street. So doesn't this signify that for the Iranian regime now, the revolution is more important than realpolitik?
I think the Egyptians should create a Reza Shah Street and then have a negotiation.
I think there's more to it than that. This, you know, the street is used as a sort of a pretext on both sides. They did have discussions. I think the Egyptians went into it because they wanted to tweak the U.S. Every now and then they like to show the Americans that they can't be taken for granted, and what better way than to have talks with the Iranians. And Larry Johnny and a bunch of others went to Egypt because it was at a particular point where Iran was looking isolated and they wanted to show that they weren't isolated. But, you know, this kind of flirtation, it happens occasionally, and there's really no need to actually consummate it. It's enough just to flirt.
By the way, you know, the Egyptians don't play the role in the region they once played. They don't have the kind of leverage. Why do the Iranians need the Egyptians? I mean, and when I was in Egypt 3 weeks ago, from the security people I was talking about, they were constantly talking about enhancing the strategic relationship between Egypt and Israel. So,
interesting.
Yeah. They saw the Iran's quest for the bomb as the really real central issue. So, you know, is there really room here for some sort of reconciliation? I doubt it. Not at the present time.
Hi, my name is Mike Hardiman. I served in civilian capacities in Iraq for a little more than 2 years. Regarding the rockets and the mortars being dropped into the green zone, usually from Sutter City, usually from the Baki Army people, every time that happens, the U.S. military immediately blames everything on Iran in line with current administration policy. My question is, does most of the weapons come from Iran because of some special effort the Iranians make, or is it just because Iran is the source of most products coming into Iraq, everything from trucks to refrigerators to electricity? And so do these weapons coming from Iran, is this some special thing, or is it just because it's another consumer product and the easiest place to get it is from Iran?
And so by extension,
is the U.S. military overblowing and overhyping this Iranian connection?
Well, I mean, the United States has found weapons caches with, you know, EFPs and 107-millimeter rockets with Iranian. They can trace it back to Iran with markings, with evidence. The Quds forces that have been arrested, I think we've arrested about 20 and released 10 so far, you know, they've been, and others have been debriefed and interrogated, and clearly the Quds forces are there to secure those weapons shipments. I mean, I think it's a little bit more deliberate and organized than the question would indicate.
Well, or I mean, they're brought in on Tata trucks from Pakistan through Iran, and they're kept perhaps at a cooler temperature by refrigerators brought in from Iran. So if you've got a tremendous number of products of all kinds coming in from Iran, I just I guess you've made your point. I've made mine. So
I understand that there, you know, there's been a lot of concern about hyping this, and various times the U.S. has said they'll show the weapons and then they don't show the weapons. But in was it in May, I think, or March, I forget, May, a delegation of Iraqi officials actually went to Iran to complain about it, and there were comments from Iraqi government officials saying that Iran was doing this, and this was the first time I'd seen those comments, so I thought that, given the delicate relationship between Iraq and Iran, I thought that was good corroboration.
Well, let me just add, Petraeus was going to give a briefing laying out the evidence in May, but Maliki and the Iraqis asked him to delay it because they want to intercede with the Iranians to get them to back down, so the briefing has been delayed.
Next question.
Brian Rudzinski from the Arms Control Association. Given your assessment, and this is really for anyone on the panel, but I guess, Barbara, since you wrote the report, given your assessment of sort of Iran's temperament and its calculations and whether it's sensitive to costs or not, and assuming we open talks with them unconditionally, do you see any circumstances that they would give up their enrichment capacity, given the prestige associated with it and given the way that Iran has expanded nuclear trade in the Middle East?
Mm-hmm. Again, that's a little bit outside the scope of the report. I think it's going to be very, very difficult. This is one of the few things that all the various factions in Iran seem to agree upon now. It's become a kind of glue that holds the place together. You would have to have a very amazing offer on the other side that the entire Iranian society would see as really, you know, worth it to give it up. That's going to be the last card dropped, and very, very hard to see how the Iranians would give that up.
My name is Ben Needles. I would argue that when you look at Iran, you talk about the outside in or inside out. Over 65% of the Iranian population is under 30. When you look at the concept of revolution in Iran, the generation in 79 saw revolution as a necessity. The generation today sees it as a luxury. And I think if you were to look at the population as a whole, they're not revolutionaries, they're nationalistic. And that's what gets towards the moves, the support for the nuclear program and whatnot. When we talk about hegemonic roles inside the region, clearly the U.S. holds one. I do not think that what Iran's focus is so much on mitigating U.S. just to mitigate the U.S. Saudi Arabia has by far been the dominant actor within the Persian Gulf for several decades. And there's been historical, you know, contention between those two elements. And so U.S. support, Israel is an excuse for Iranian revolutionary action to justify its role as being someone else. It's not the driver. It's a soapbox that they're able to leverage. And they can't let go of the soapbox until they're able to solidify their role as the hegemon within the Persian Gulf. So I have some contention with the argument that there's this, that revolution is the driving factor. Maybe with Ahmadinejad, he's out there enough. He's a true believer, I think, in that concept. But if you look at the overarching premise of the population, and I take some issue with the concept that, you know, U.S. action has caused Iran to rise to where it is today. I don't think you would be seeing Iran do the things that they're doing today if oil was $45 a barrel.
Absolutely.
That has emboldened. If you look at how he came to power in Iran, it was based off of economic promises. It wasn't based off of revolutionary promises. You have a very dissatisfied population inside Iran because of the economic situation there. I think the final card that's going to cause some issue with the nuclear is not going to be bringing to the table a gift basket. It's going to be when the United Nations and the global economy sits back and says, okay, we are now going to sanction your oil program. Because once that happens, Iran no longer has an ability to continue a lot of the policies that it has developed. So I think there's a lot more of an economic driver and what's going on behind their actions than there is this concept of ideology.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. You know, again, I don't see Iran, I see Iran as opportunistic, not revolutionary, even though obviously the ideology is still there and son, but it certainly, when it comes to the ordinary Iranian, there is very little interest in Israel, the Palestinians, Hezbollah, any of this. They're all concerned with their own economic situation, the leadership, Some are true believers. Some just exploit these issues to stay in power. But I do think that the U.S. activities have made a big difference in terms of increasing the price of oil. I mean, the price of oil was $20 a barrel when Bush came in. So one has to say that it's that the actions of the United States have had something to do with the increase in the price of oil, all the conflicts in the region, all the threats, and then, of course, getting rid of these governments that were opposed. On sanctioning the oil program, I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, my God, the price of oil would go to $300 a barrel. We're in bad enough shape as it is. So that's why Iran gets to continue its activities. I don't know, maybe Danny has some others. You still think they're revolutionary?
Well, no, I just say it's not an either-or proposition. Right. Again, we constantly come up with these black and whites. I mean, I wrote a book about Iran, which the focus of which is the multiple sorts of ideological foundations of this. It's a complex and in that sense, almost unique kind of revolutionary institutional realpolitik being. And it's not one thing or the other. And what we do in the Washington debate is, in order to get a policy point across, we invoke one argument or the other to support it. I'm simply saying that things are related in complex ways, and that's part of the problem we're facing. Iran is many things. I do not think, however, that Iranian youth under 30 control Iranian foreign policy.
Right.
I mean, Iranian young people are fed up with this status quo and have very little power to change it. Unfortunately, under Ahmadinejad, he brought in it was already happening before he came in. He brought in a political apparatus, which is heavily, and an economic apparatus, which is heavily invested, not in promoting revolutions, but revolutionary ideology. Those are two different things. I'm not saying they want revolutions. They want revolutionary movements, because those movements are an extension of their power, you know, and which facilitates their power for good, rational reasons as well. So we're talking about a complex set of factors. My policy prescription, to the extent that I have one, is that we have to find ways that diminish the revolutionary aspects of Iranian behavior, so we can have a more rational debate and use the more conventional levers to elicit responses from the Iranians that are more in our interest. By the way, as far as Iran, the price of oil, I mean, American SUV drivers combined with the Chinese middle class, as far as I'm concerned, is responsible. But it's true. I mean, we've driven up the price in part by our own consumption, right. And we have a set of demands now from countries, including India, China, which really have driven up the demand of oil in ways that nobody expected, because the Chinese economy has advanced so quickly, so fast, and therefore the demand for energy is really is in part driving what's going on. And that, even if the tensions diminish in the region, that structural change is not going to go away. I don't think, you know, unfortunately we're going to see high oil prices and a reinvigorated the Iranian oil industry is the foundation of, in some sense, of Iranian politics, to the extent that by distributing the rent from the oil industry, that's how all these organizations are funded. And so when the price of oil goes up, these organizations, their batteries are recharged institutionally and ideologically.
Taking another question. Diane Perlman, Transcend Conflict Transformation Network. First of all, thank you so much for this work. I think we really need it badly. And according to connecting a lot of dots, it seems like there's a lot of escalation of tensions and provocation that could trigger off something, as we all understand. And my question is about some of the misperceptions and acting out of misinterpretations that has the opposite effect. You talked a lot about backlash or the law of opposites. So basically from terror management theory and also some of the work of Terror Free Tomorrow, that the more provocative and threatening and punitive we are, the more we increase popularity of charismatic leaders on their side and both sides, like the mirror image of the enemy. And it seems to me that from the Iranian perspective, the nuclear program has to do with national pride and also a deterrent from us, but we in Israel perceive it as they're threatening us. And I also observed AIPAC, and like every single speech was about, you know, they're threatening us. They want, and I hear things from Israel that they're expecting an attack, and they think that they have to attack. So acting, you know, people are more dangerous when they're acting out of fear and misperception. And you know, the big thrust here, what I hear all over, is for sanctions. and from my beginning review of some of the literature on sanctions, and also from what you're describing of the psychological dynamics, that they're likely to have the opposite effect of increasing defiance. But people are so gripped and completely think that they'll work, and we don't want to be violent, and we have to do that because there's nothing else. But given what you just said also about that they want to be normal, have a normal state, have normal relations, and all their overtures that we keep rejecting, which creates more humiliation and resentment and just feeling rejection like any of us would. So, what would you say to people who believe that sanctions are going to work and that we have to do that and that we can't mm-hmm. talk and all that?
Well, I'd agree with Dan that it's not either or. Sanctions can be very useful, and they have had an impact. Unfortunately, they're probably hurting the ordinary Iranian now more than they're hurting the Iranian government. And originally, the intention was that they were going to hurt the government, but not the people. You really can't do that. No, I think there's a place for it. I think that's part of the economic leverage that the United States has, and that if the U.S. were to begin a negotiating process, certainly we would hold on to those sanctions. And we've just seen an example now with the North Koreans, this week, where the U.S. has lifted some sanctions, promises to lift more if the North Koreans follow through on their agreement to denuclearize. And that sets a pattern, perhaps, with Iran. Iran, of course, needs it less because of the high price of oil. Where I do agree with you is that some of the threatening language, I think, has been counterproductive. Certainly argued that our neoconservatives have fed Iran's neoconservatives, that Ahmadinejad has benefited enormously, that he has tried to attract opposition because it puffs him up. So you do have a very unhealthy dynamic going on between the two countries, and particularly between the peoples who demonize each other in the two countries, and it would be nice to lower the level of the rhetoric.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead with the last round of questions, take all three of you, and then we'll turn to the panel for final comments.
Thank you. My name is Shakir Jawad. I'm from International Health Office at DOD. I have two questions, in fact. The first question is, if we consider Islam as a radical Islam as a global threat, where do you see Iran standing in this whole process? Are Iranian ambitions local only to the region because of the being Shia, that's a local sect within the region of Iran, or Iran is around, or like Iran is looking for a more global role and like leading Islam towards this? And the second question is, do you see any kind of Iranian resistance? Is there a resistant group that's fighting just to get rid of the clerical regime in Iran? Or like whether silent or active, and if there is like you advocated that you would go for reach out to Iran and try to improve ties. And is there a civil society that's mature inside Iran that one can go through and do this? Is it outside the umbrella of the government? Is there a way that we can talk to those people, or is it very much difficult and it's going to be monitored very much by the Iranian government? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good question.
Thank you for the great presentation. I'm Michael Kraft, a counterterrorism specialist, former State Department. Following up the weapons issue and Dan's comments that there's a desire in the Iranians to support the revolutionary movements, but there's a difference between weapons. I mean, it's one thing to provide, relatively small arms, but where it becomes a issue, with all due respect to Barbara, for example, Hamas, maybe only a small part of their weapons are from Iranian, but if they're long-range rockets, and just Hezbollah's got long-range rockets that can hit Haifa, or in Hamas' case, Ashkelon, to what extent do you think there's a theory that part of the Iranian support for these two groups is a counter-pressure against either an American or Israeli possible nuclear counter-strike? Or preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. They're using Iran or these groups as weapons. Also, in some ways, Iran has been conducting an undeclared war against the U.S. for a while, I think, using Hezbollah.
And vice versa.
Yeah, but the attacks on the Marine barracks and the embassies in Beirut, Khobar Towers, etc. Do you think Iran is still inclined to be following that line of action, either as a countermeasure or just to tweak us occasionally? Because I think there's a lot of evidence that Iran indeed has been conducting undeclared war against us, and we've sort of let it slide for various reasons. And finally, on the sanctions issue, I agree with Barbara, they can be important. The real issue, in answer to this woman, with sanctions, they're trying to get governments to think twice before supporting terrorist attacks or other things. It's not always easy to gauge them. The North Korea example, this has been going on for at least 8 years when Mike Sheehan, who was my former boss at counterterrorism office, was involved in negotiations. So they always don't take a bite easily. But in the case of Libya, these sanctions have had some effect. So it's a intermediate step sometimes, but before having to go military. But it also has to be coupled with some strong carrots. And I think with Iran's economic problems, there's a lot more that can be explored there, too, as part of a package. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to this mic.
Hi, Zamfami. I'm just a student. I have a quick question to Barbara or any of the panelists. There's a very strong Shia militia movement in northern Yemen. I don't know if you had heard about that. Recently, it's been getting very strong, and it's been getting closer to the capital, and they've been battling government for quite a while. I don't know if that's mentioned in your report, and if so, is it linked any way to Iran economically or politically? Thank you.
And one last question.
Sorry, I slipped in there. Jill Perlow, okay. Physicians for Social Responsibility. Both, this is towards Ken and Barbara, you both made a good case for Iran being either opportunistic or revolutionary. I was wondering if we can combine the different sectors in Iran, or if we could talk separately of Larry Johnny's following and Ahmadinejad's following being either opportunistic or revolutionary, and if you could provide proof for that in both cases. And then this could be a silly question, but it's a very quick question. Was Meqtada al-Sadr connected at all with Chalabi? Do you know anything about any connection between
Ahmed Chalabi?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you want to lead off? Why don't we end with Barb? So we'll start at the far side with Kenneth and then come on down.
Larry Johnny, maybe I differ a little. I don't see him. I mean, he's been pretty conservative. He was head of the state broadcasting. I don't think he would differ that much with the foreign policy outlines. What I think Lara Johnny's, theory would be: move slowly. Don't bring the entire world against you. Don't provoke a coalition that's going to slow you down. Move methodically. Move slowly. Whereas Ahmadinejad is more willing to sort of lead with his chin and take lumps as he goes and try to strike. Almost a blitzkrieg type approach, let's say. Not that dramatic,
that.
But all right, we won't use that. But we're using a lot of World War II analogies here.
No analogy.
By the way,
a pre-Cold War.
We did not have good intelligence at Midway. It took us 4 hours to find those carriers. But anyway. Okay. What was the second question? The question was about
Yemen.
No, don't have anything on that. But there was another thing, Joe. What was? Sadr and Chalabi. Oh my goodness. Chalabi is sort of advising a number of Islamist Shias. He's visited Sistani any number of times. He's advised the Supreme Council. He's down in Najaf a lot. He has mentored Sadr. He tried to sort of nudge Sadr into the political mainstream and, into an alliance with Hakim and Maliki. and so he's still playing that role. He's sort of a broker, a go-between among the Shia factions. And now he's been involved in sort of getting streetlights put on in Baghdad and implementing some public works programs with the U.S. military there.
Just really one minute on maybe on Mike's question in part about this issue of provision of the quality of weapons provided by Iran to Hezbollah and Hamas and the use of these as potential deterrent against some sort of Israeli-U.S. strike. I think clearly it seems to me that tensions in the region are rising, worries are increasing that the Israelis may decide that they need to take matters into their own hands with respect to Iran's developing nuclear ambitions and initiate some kind of preemptive strike. I would certainly, I think the consensus or conventional wisdom is, and I would concur with it, that Hezbollah certainly in Lebanon would retaliate rather quickly in the event of such an attack. And I think, again, we would see sort of a, I would call it almost, not to exaggerate too much, but a cataclysmic response in the region should that happen.
Okay, very quickly. First of all, never say you're just a student. You're a student. I say that as a professor. So, the 2 points. First of all, I don't think the Iranian revolutionary sort of impulse, I think it's much more focused on the Middle East. When it comes to the global politics of Iran, the further you get away, Indonesia, Malaysia, the more it looks like a more realpolitik sort of approach. So the kinds of things I'm talking about are much more focused on the Middle East. And the other point I want to make very quickly is on this Larijani. It's true that Larijani was forced out for a number of reasons, including his willingness to compromise on certain kinds of things. Now, from the perspective of the Washington policy environment, that's a good or bad thing. I mean, for some folks, the go slow approach offers an opportunity to come to some sort of arrangement that we can live with, which will be far from perfect, but we're going to live with it. And that means, as Ken Pollack points out in his book, sort of living with Iran that has the bomb, and how can we do that, in effect, by really sort of coming up with a diplomatic solution. For others, Larijani is a threat because that's not an acceptable outcome. But I do think, from my perspective, that the boundary between tactics and strategy is fuzzy, and that Larijani is still, in many respects, and what he represents and his allies represent a more pragmatic sort of camp that we can negotiate with. Although I recognize, he comes from the Revolutionary Guard, so does Ahmadinejad, so does Caliban, after all. They all come from the Revolutionary Guard, and they all are, to some extent, believers in the revolutionary ideology.
Just quickly on the question of whether Iran sees itself as a sort of pan-Islamic power. I mean, it does and it doesn't. Again, even close to home, Iran supports Armenia against Azerbaijan. Iran did not get involved in Chechnya to avoid annoying the Russians. So, you know, true. They can be very, very pragmatic, very calibrate this very carefully. And I accept what Mike said about the long-range rockets. Absolutely, that is a threat, and I think it is an example of the way in which Iran seeks deterrence against an Israeli or U.S. attack. I see a lot of what they do in terms of arming these groups in terms of their own deterrence. On the question of Iranian resistance and civil society, unfortunately, this is a kind of sad tale. There was a civil society that was maturing, and I would argue that U.S. policies, particularly under President Bush, have decimated it, because what you have now is a situation where anybody who has any contact with foreigners, with Westerners, is considered to be a spy, terrible repression. Civil society has just been really forced underground. You don't have any particular group or any particular individual who could emerge to lead the opposition to the current regime, the way things are going now. And I would say that a reduction in tensions between the United States and Iran would actually permit this opposition to reemerge and to reorganize. And then there was one other thing. Yeah, this notion of an undeclared war by Iran against the United States. There certainly have been times when Iran has supported terrorism against the United States. Lebanon in the 1980s, Khobar Towers was mentioned. This was an incident in Saudi Arabia in 1996. Saudi Shia carried out the attack and apparently had Iranian support. I think we've seen it again in Iraq. There was a long period, particularly under Khatami, when this ended. And unfortunately, it has come back, and it's come back because the United States is sitting on Iran's doorstep and saying threatening things. So in terms of a broader covert war against the United States, we don't see it now. We could see it if there was a military attack against Iran.
Thank you very much. I'd like to perhaps give a round of applause for Barb Slavin for a very fine and provocative report. I'd like to thank our discussants, Ken Katzman, Mona Yacoubian, and Dan Bromberg, for their insightful comments.